I want to start today with a question that sounds like it belongs on a high school physics quiz. But according to the material we're covering today, it's actually the gateway to a completely different way of seeing reality.
Okay, hit me. I'm ready.
What causes a baseball to fly?
Well, if I answer like a modern person, I'd say the bat. Or more specifically, the force exerted by the batter transferring kinetic energy to the ball, mass times acceleration.
Exactly. And that answer gets you an A in physics class. It gets you a pat on the back from Isaac Newton. But here is the hook for our deep dive today. If you gave that exact answer to Aristotle, he wouldn't just say you're wrong. He would say you are woefully incomplete. He'd probably tell you that you're doing half a science.
Only half. That's a pretty tough grade.
Maybe even less. Today, we are unpacking a really fascinating lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes on the history of philosophy, specifically focusing on Aristotle's metaphysics. We're going to explore why Aristotle thinks our modern view of the world, which basically just atoms bumping into atoms, is missing the biggest parts of the picture. We're talking about his famous four causes, the hidden purpose in nature, and the absolute unbreakable rules of logic that keep our reality from dissolving into chaos.
This is heavy stuff, but it's crucial because it forces you to ask whether the world is just a machine that runs blindly, or if there's a built-in purpose, a why, embedded in the very fabric of existence.
So let's go back to that baseball. Or actually, let's use the example Dr. Holmes uses in the lecture, which is a bit more classical. A sculptor making a statue, specifically Rodin's The Thinker.
Right. Holmes uses art because it's sometimes easier for us to spot purpose in art than it is in nature. So imagine a sculptor chiseling away at a block of stone. If we want to explain why that statue exists, we can't just say the sculptor hit it.
That's what Aristotle calls the efficient cause, right?
Correct. The efficient cause is the source of the change. It's the force. The sculptor's muscles, the hammer, the chisel. It's what we modern people usually mean when we say cause. But Aristotle says, hang on. If that sculptor was hitting a block of wood instead of stone, or I don't know, a pile of water, would the result be the same?
Obviously not. You can't carve water. And wood has a grain. It splits differently. It looks completely different.
Exactly. So the material itself dictates the outcome. That is the second cause, the material cause. The stuff matters. You just can't separate the result from what it's made of.
Okay, so we have the guy hitting it, that's efficient, and the stone itself, that's material. But a pile of gravel is also stone that someone hit with a hammer. The thinker is something specific. It's not just rubble.
And this is where we get into the heavy hitters of Aristotle's thought. The third factor is the formal cause.
The form. This is a word that gets thrown around a lot in philosophy. What does he actually mean here?
Think of it as the essence, the definition. If the sculptor is carving the thinker, the idea of the thinker, the posture, the shape, the very essence of that figure is guiding every strike of the hammer. The form is immanent in the process. It's what makes the stone into something rather than just anything.
So it's like the blueprint, but more than just a paper drawing. It's the identity of the thing holding it together.
Precisely. It's the whatness of the thing. But even that isn't enough. Aristotle asks one more question, perhaps the most important one. Why is the sculptor doing it at all? Why make the thinker and not a gargoyle? Or why not just go take a nap?
Well, maybe to get paid. Or to make something beautiful.
Right. Or in the example from the classical world that Holmes uses to adorn the Parthenon, there is a goal, a purpose. Aristotle calls this the final cause, the telos.
Telos, that means the end or the goal.
Yes. And this is crucial because the final cause dictates everything else. This is the part we so often forget today. If the purpose is to adorn a massive temple roof to be seen from the ground, the statue needs to be huge. It needs exaggerated features so they can be seen from a distance.
Right, that makes sense.
The material needs to be weather-resistant marble, not clay, because it has to sit outside for centuries. The efficient cause, the chiseling, has to be harder and more forceful.
So the purpose, the future goal, actually determines the present action.
That is the key insight. You cannot explain the statue without the purpose. It pulls the action forward. And here is where it gets wild. Aristotle doesn't just apply this to art, he applies it to nature.
And this is where modern ears might prick up a bit. Because we're used to thinking of nature as well as just biological machinery. But Dr. Holmes brings up the example of reproduction to explain this.
He does. And we have to note, as Holmes explicitly does in his lecture, that Aristotle had a very ancient and frankly chauvinistic view of biology. He viewed the female role in reproduction as purely providing the matter, while the male provided the force.
Yeah, Holmes calls it a chauvinistic attitude to women in antiquity.
He does. It's important to acknowledge that historical context. I mean, Aristotle was working with the biology of 300 BC, but if we look past the outdated biological mechanics to the philosophical structure he's building, it's really interesting. Aristotle looks at a child being born and asks, what caused this?
Okay, let's break it down using the four causes again.
So in his view, the mother provides the material cause, the body, the stuff. The father provides the efficient cause, the source of motion. But then there's the big question, why does the child turn out to be a human and not a horse?
Because of the formal cause, the essence of humanity.
Right. The form is transmitted. And finally, the final cause. The purpose is to produce an offspring that creates a new generation, to reproduce the form, to continue the species.
So for Aristotle, nature isn't just a machine grinding away. It's a system where things are striving to fulfill a purpose.
That is the aha moment. Aristotle critiqued his predecessors, guys like Thales, who thought everything was water, or Empedocles, who focused on earth, air, fire, and water. He essentially told them, you guys are obsessed with the material cause. You're looking at the ingredients, but you're ignoring the recipe and the reason for cooking dinner.
They missed the pilos.
Exactly. Aristotle's big contribution is the idea that nature implies purpose.
I want to push on that nature implies purpose idea a bit more. Because when I look at an acorn, I just see a nut. I don't see a future oak tree striving to get out. It looks pretty static to me.
Well, Aristotle would say you aren't looking closely enough at the potential. This is the concept of inner teleology. The acorn has the specific potential, the potency, to become an oak. It doesn't have the potential to become a rosebush or a dolphin.
It's basically programmed to rack.
Programmed is a good modern metaphor. The form is imminent. It's inside the acorn. Nature, according to Aristotle, never makes anything without a purpose. It is always moving from potentiality to actuality. It's trying to become what it is meant to be.
Dr. Holmes mentioned something really poetic about this regarding art and discovery. He said that for Aristotle, an artist isn't really creating in the way we think of it.
This is a beautiful distinction. In the 19th century, the Romantics loved the idea of the creative genius who makes something out of nothing, purely from their own soul, like a mini god creating a universe. But Aristotle, he would say the artist discovers.
Discovers, like an archaeologist.
Yes. The musician doesn't invent sound. They discover the potential for harmony that already exists in the physics of air and vibration. The sculptor discovers the form that is possible within the grain of the wood.
So the potential is already there in the reality of the world. The artist just actualizes it.
Exactly. It's a much more humble and perhaps more connected way of viewing human creativity. We are cooperating with the potential of the universe, teasing out what is already waiting to exist.
That is a lovely thought. But hold on, let me play devil's advocate here. If nature is so perfect and purposeful and everything has a goal, what about when things go wrong? What about accidents? Dr. Holmes talks about chance. If I'm walking down the street and I get bitten by a mosquito, was that the purpose of the universe? Did the universe conspire to make me itchy?
That is a great question. Aristotle doesn't say that specific event was the final cause of your life or the mosquito's life. He explains chance as the intersection of two independent lines of cause and effect.
Like a traffic accident, two paths crossing.
Right. You have a purpose. Walking to the store to buy milk, that's chain A. The mosquito has a purpose. Finding food, that's chain B. When those two chains cross, the bite is accidental to your purpose. It wasn't your goal. But it wasn't uncaused.
It's just the collision of extraneous factors.
Exactly. It's not random chaos in the sense that nothing caused this. It's just complex traffic. The mosquito was following its nature, you were following yours, and they just happened to intersect at the wrong moment for you.
So this worldview where everything has a natural goal, a place where it belongs, this dominated Western thought for a long time, didn't it?
For centuries. This was the bedrock of the Middle Ages. It fit perfectly with medieval theology. If nature has a purpose, that implies a designer. It implies order. It implies that everything has a meaning.
But obviously, we don't think like this anymore. If I go to a physics lab today, they aren't talking about the love inside a rock making it fall. Something shifted. And Dr. Holmes points out that it wasn't just scientists who started questioning this. Surprisingly, it was theologians.
This is a nuance many people miss. We often think the story is science versus religion. But actually, in the late Middle Ages, you had thinkers like William of Ockham and later reformers like Martin Luther and John Calvin who got really uncomfortable with Aristotle.
Why? I thought the church loved the order Aristotle provided.
They did, but these specific thinkers felt Aristotle's rules were too strict. If nature has these unbreakable forms and potencies, it almost seems like God has to follow them too.
Oh, I see. Like God is bound by the rule book of the universe.
Exactly. It limited God's sovereignty. They wanted God to be able to do whatever he wanted, not just what the acorn was programmed to do. They wanted to emphasize God's will over God's intellect.
So they wanted to loosen the rules of form and final cause to make room for divine power.
In a way, yes. This is called voluntarism. But then the scientific revolution came along, Newton and the gang, and they finished the job, but for entirely different reasons.
This is the birth of the machine universe.
Exactly. Newtonian physics was incredibly successful, but notice what it kept and what it threw away from Aristotle's list. Newton kept matter, the material cause, and force, the efficient cause.
Mass and acceleration, the stuff and the push.
But he stripped out form and purpose. In Newtonian physics, a rock doesn't fall because it desires to be at the center of the earth, which is what Aristotle thought. It falls because gravity pulls it. There is no internal goal. There is only external force.
So we lost the why.
We lost the formal and final causes. And that is why, from an Aristotelian perspective, modern science is only half a science. It describes the mechanics perfectly. Mm. It can tell you exactly how the rock falls, but it is silent on the meaning. It can't tell you what the rock really is in its essence or why it exists.
And then David Hume comes along and just ruins the party completely.
Hume is the ultimate skeptic. He looks at the stripped-down mechanical universe and says, wait a minute, you guys are talking about force and cause, but do you actually see the cause?
What does he mean?
He says, look at two billiard balls. Ball A hits ball B. You see ball A move, then you see they touch. Then you see ball B move. You see a sequence of events. But do you see the power? Do you see the force transferring?
I guess not. I just see the movement.
Exactly. Hume argued we have no empirical knowledge of efficient cause. We just see habits, patterns. We don't see power. So we went from Aristotle's four rich causes down to Newton's two. And then Hume questioned if we even have those.
That leaves us in a pretty skeptical place. It feels like the floor is falling out. We went from a universe full of purpose to a universe where we can't even prove one thing hits another.
It does lead to a crisis of knowledge. But Dr. Holmes doesn't end the lecture there. He pivots. He takes us from the physical world, which is changeable and uncertain, to the world of logic itself.
Right. He moves to metaphysics as the science of being. Aristotle wants to know not just how things move, but how things are. And he lays down the ground rules for thinking.
The first principles.
Specifically, the law of non-contradiction.
The most certain principle of all.
Let's define it clearly. What is the rule?
The rule is a thing cannot be and not be at the same time and in the same respect.
Okay. I cannot be in this studio and not in this studio, right?
Correct. You could be in the studio today and not in the studio tomorrow. That's different times. You could be in the studio physically, but not in the studio mentally daydreaming about lunch. That's different respects. But you cannot physically be here and physically be absent at this exact second.
It seems obvious, almost too obvious to mention. Why does Aristotle make such a big deal out of this?
Because it's the foundation of everything. And Aristotle asks a very tricky question. Can you prove it?
Well, can you?
Not directly. Think about it. Any proof relies on logic. And logic relies on this law. If you try to prove logic using logic, you're arguing in a circle. You're assuming the thing you're trying to prove.
So we just have to take it on faith. That feels unsatisfying for a guy like Aristotle.
Not quite. He offers what he calls a negative demonstration. This is brilliant intellectual jujitsu. He says, okay, you don't believe the law of non-contradiction. Fine, say something. Say anything meaningful.
Okay, I'll say the rug is red.
Great. Now, when you say the rug is red, do you mean that it is red or do you mean that it is not red?
I mean, it's red, obviously.
Exactly. By making a statement, you are assuming that your words have a specific meaning and exclude the opposite meaning. If the rug is red meant both it is red and it is not red at the same time, you aren't speaking English, you aren't conveying information, you're speaking gobbledygook.
I see where this is going. To even disagree with the law, I have to use the law.
Exactly. Suppose you say, I believe the law of non-contradiction is false. Aristotle would ask, do you mean it is false or do you mean it is true?
If I say it is false, I am excluding the possibility that it is true. I am defining my terms. I am using the law of non-contradiction to deny the law of non-contradiction.
You've walked right into his trap.
Yeah.
You cannot engage in any meaningful thought or communication without assuming that A is A and not non-A. If you try to deny it, you prove it. It's inescapable.
That is incredibly sturdy. It feels like hitting bedrock.
It is bedrock. It's the absolute floor of reality. And Holmes mentions that some people try to wiggle out of it. They claim that Eastern philosophy or thinkers like Hegel deny this law.
Right, the thesis-antithesis-synthesis idea, that contradictions are part of progress.
But Holmes defends the law here. Huda points out that Hegel's dialectic happens over time. Thesis creates tension, which leads to antithesis, which resolves into synthesis. That is a process. It happens chronologically. It doesn't violate the rule at the same time.
So even in complex philosophy, you can't escape the basic rules of existence.
No. Whether it's the four causes in nature or the laws of logic in our minds, Aristotle is showing us a universe that has structure. It's not just random noise. It's not just distinct atoms floating in a void.
So let's wrap this up. We started with the baseball and ended up with the fundamental laws of truth.
That is the beauty of metaphysics. It connects the physical to the philosophical.
We've seen that for Aristotle, to fully understand reality, you need more than just force and matter. You need to understand the form, what something is, and the final cause, what it is for.
And even though modern science has largely discarded those last two to focus on mechanics, our minds still crave them. We naturally ask, what is this and why is it here? We are naturally Aristotelian in how we navigate the world. We look for purpose.
And we operate on that bedrock of logic. We assume that reality is consistent, that truth exists.
We do. We have to. Otherwise, we couldn't even have this conversation.
So here's the thought I want to leave you with today. We live in a culture that sometimes likes to play with the idea of relative truth. You hear people say things like, there are no absolute truths, or contradictions are fine.
It sounds sophisticated at a dinner party. It sounds open-minded.
It does. But thinking back to Aristotle's negative demonstration, the next time someone tells you there is no absolute truth, ask yourself, do they mean that statement absolutely?
Because if they do, they just proved you right. They just stated an absolute truth. And if they don't mean it, well, then why are you listening to them?
Something to think about. Thanks for diving in with us.
Pleasure as always.